next year. I want you, oh, I want you over, baby, for summer. Hear me, baby, say I want you over. I want you over, baby, for summer. The way you win it and the way you bang it up, bend it over like if it's a double top. No lies, anytime I look in your eyes, girl, you know I love you, no lies. Wanna smoke a little spliff and bana with you, baby. I told you, none of these guys, none of them got nothing for you. Oh wow, so tell me, babe, will you be my sugar, baby? Daddy give you peace of mind, baby, no be lie. I could be your sugar, baby, if you give me peace of mind, baby, look in my eyes. Will you be my sugar, baby? Daddy give you peace of mind, make you realize that I love you, no lies. That I love you, no lies. Yeah, I want you, oh, I want you over, baby, for summer. Hear me, baby, say I want you over. I want you over, baby, for summer.
Thank you. Ik doe graag mee. Ik werk graag samen. Ik luister graag naar andere mensen. Ik luister graag naar. Flexibel. Ik ben standvastig. Ik overzie de dingen. Ik let op de. Ik ben zo lief. Ik ben zo lief. Als de situatie daarom vraagt, ik ben gericht op resultaat. Het traject is erg. Het traject is erg belangrijk. Ik droom vaak. Droom vaak van mijn duidige usability. En online. Usability. Het zijn mooie dromen. Het zijn mooie dromen. Het zijn mooie dromen. Ik ben erg. Ik ben erg. Ik ben erg. Gemotiveerd. Heil. 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 Heil.
On Lover's Island, we where the trees stand so tall, we and the dust turns to gold, we and love now that grows old. On Lover's Island, be where the birds sing of love, be since the gift from up above, be I met her one day.
Like the dog that died next to my hotel. Don't you know the fire? This is enough. Watching you in the sunlight. Feeling all the lights. Feeling all the nights in the day. I said fight to live. You know when you can't try to save me. Fight, just live. It's amazing timing used to know. Don't you know the fire? That you know the fire. Just another day, just another day. Can't stop feeling it at night. Don't you know the fire? That you know the fire. Just another day, just another day. Can't stop feeling it at night.
You're listening to the Santiago Boys, the amazing story of a democratic tech utopia that could have been. I'm your host, Evgeny Morozov. In our previous episode, we learned how cybersyn was increasingly under attack, and from many sides at once. From leftists who distrusted it, from journalists who ridiculed it, and even from engineers who misinterpreted it. And we saw how its makers struggled to persuade Allende's government to adopt the system, with Allende himself feeling increasingly isolated. Coming up on this episode, even more drama and intrigue. Stafford almost abandoned cybersyn, going on a spiritual quest as a hippie rebel. Fernando Flores, in turn, is threatened by someone who wants to take over the project. And we'll also hear about the last meeting between Allende and Stafford, the meeting before everything would change forever. Stay with us. They had a vision of a new kind of socialism powered by computers, the Santiago Boys. But things are falling apart in their Chile. The economy is crashing, the streets are dangerous, and those milk spoons, well, they aren't helping it either. Milk itself is harder and harder to come by, especially when people are eating the cows instead of milking them. And then something happens that chokes everyone. The biggest copper miner in the country goes on strike. The mine that belongs to the government. The mine that Allende needs in order to fund his revolution. It's a disaster waiting to happen.
El Teniente is a mine, a very strong mine that is a little bit to the south of Santiago.
This is Sergio Bitar, then Allende's Minister of Mining.
The problem there was that one leader of the Socialist Party among the workers led the strike against Allende.
This is what Allende's revolution has come to. Members of his own party are now striking against him. And the workers are joining them too. The opposition sees an opportunity and wants to take advantage. A nationwide protest is already in the works, with hopes of repeating the transportation strike. And now the miners are even marching on Santiago, ready to make their voices heard. Now, a few weeks later, as they come to compromise with Allende and return to work, it seems like the conflict might finally be resolved. But just as things start to calm down, the situation takes a turn for the worse. Reports of attacks and intimidation against the miners begin to flood in. Meanwhile, the technicians of those mines continue their protest, and the battle for production grinds to a halt. The usual split between workers and experts rears its ugly head again. It seems that Allende just can't get both of them on his side at once. Sergio Bitar, with his Harvard education and his highbrow credentials, finds himself struggling to tame this chaos.
There was no vision of a process, of a rhythm.
And if things weren't bad enough, the opposition votes him out of office. With the country in turmoil, can Allende muster the strength to fight back? And how many will follow him? Amidst growing violence, the Santiago boys are confronted with a brutal reality. Their Talix networks are no match for the terrorist networks of their enemies. And many of those enemies come from Patria y Libertad. As usual, they are planting bombs and sabotaging crucial infrastructures. And many of their tactics are very similar to those that the CIA used in Cuba in the early 1960s, in that notorious Operation Mongoose. Gabriel Rodriguez recalls the intense psychological toll of constant terror.
This has never happened in this country. One thing is putting Miguelitos on the road in order for the trucks to get stopped. But something different, and when you have these bombs exploding in different places.
The tension in Chile's political arena mounts with each passing day. The government coalition struggling to maintain its unity against violent attacks. The conflicting viewpoints of Salvador Allende and his daughter Beatriz reflect this growing schism within popular unity. Tanya Harmer explains.
The differences between Beatriz and her father are really, really boil down to differences over how they might begin to prepare most effectively to meet a potential coup d'etat against the government.
We are back to the long-running debate about people's power versus technocrats' power.
These divisions are on the one hand between those who believe that in order to prepare for a coup, the best thing is to mobilize supporters, to prepare militarily, to covertly start stockpiling weapons, and to really move forward without kind of negotiation or hesitancy. That's really Beatriz's side.
But Allende takes a different tack. He opts for negotiation with the opposition and, of course, the military. He still thinks that they will eventually respect the constitution and that his way of doing things, the peaceful one, will be able to prevail. Project Cybersyn is not immune to all this turmoil. There are now competing visions of what exactly cybernetic software is supposed to do. Stafford Beer thinks it's a tool for the people. Others on the team take a more limited view, seeing it as nothing but an experimental tool for managing the economy. And a prototype, really. And a technocratic one at that. That conflict over vision and strategy could tear Cybersyn apart. How will they resolve it? And will they? As Chilean leftists cannot seemingly agree on anything, their far-right opponents are ramping up their terror. A Chilean graffiti bearing the menacing logo of Patria y Libertad gets scrawled across the walls of President Allende's own residence. It's a stark reminder that no one is beyond their reach. Not even the president. Carlos Sena, the latest Brazilian addition to the Cybersyn team, is already bracing for the worst. It's almost like he's reliving the prelude to the 1964 coup back in his native Brazil. A coup that set the stage for brutal torture by the new military regime and, of course, for his own exile.
INTEC, the Instituto de Investigaciones Tecnológicas, was threatened by the Patria Libertad, the right-wing armed group of the right. And so I was invited to join the technicians who would defend the Instituto who would keep armed guards during the night.
Carlos may have lived through one coup already, but it's obvious that no training or experience could match the lethal weaponry of groups like Patria y Libertad. The Santiago boys find themselves woefully outgunned.
They had machine guns and they had bombs. And I was given a hunting rifle with some cartridges. How could I, with a hunting rifle to kill birds, with a field cartridge, face fascists with bombs and machine guns? It was completely nonsense, rubbish.
Carlos and his friends may not have the most formidable arsenal, but they do have one secret weapon.
The girls, the institutes, they helped us providing some empanadas, delicious empanadas.
And yet, they opt for cocktails of Allende's red wine. But cocktails of a very special kind.
They did Molotov cocktails, they had the bottles, they have the elements, everything. So they provided Molotov cocktails and we kept guards with hunting rifles.
But can these nerds truly go toe-to-toe with Molotov cocktail veterans like Mike Townley of Patria Libertad? After all, he's still the unchallenged cocktail kingpin of Santiago. As Cyberson gets mired in red tape and internal debates, Stafford Beer has taken up another bold venture, Project Cyberfog. By broadcasting debates from the operations room and measuring public opinion, he's hoping to deepen democracy and truly revolutionize politics. It's something of a sibling to Project Cyberson, much smaller in scope, but very big on ambition and vision. As, of course, is usually the case with Stafford Beer. His aim is to use the charmingly named Algedonic Mirror, a gadget designed by his son, to create a feedback loop, a loop between citizens and politicians, something which could transform politics as we know it. Everything will become interconnected, with citizens and politicians taking cues from each other and responding to feedback in real time. This will mark the beginning of a true participatory democracy in Chile, a cybernetic democracy.
The workforce knows that the president knows how they feel. And worse, the president knows that the workforce knows that he knows. And so you can go on indefinitely.
Stafford claims he has sold Allende on that idea, but other priorities intervene.
I've never found anybody else with the guts to try.
Stafford is also bringing cybernetics to the masses with a passion and enthusiasm that's truly infectious.
I got into very close friendship with a number of the leading Chilean singers, guitarists, songwriters, and I even wrote songs myself about cybernetics, would you believe?
He's even looking to Cuba. Yes, Cuba, for inspiration.
We wanted to use slogans because Chileans were very aware of the role that these had played in the Cuban government.
For this British management consultant, touting Cuba as a model is a very bold and provocative move. It's as if he's deliberately trying to provoke his peers at the esteemed Athenaeum Club. It's really not the kind of place that would host a book talk by Fidel Castro. By then, this father of eight, yes, we are talking about Stafford, has another thrilling Chilean adventure on his mind. And this adventure involves more than just sightseeing. His daughter Vanilla remembers him broaching this delicate subject.
One of the things we discussed was the possibility of him fathering a child in Chile. He was quite keen on the idea. He'd been invited to become a father there.
I can give you a list of my friends at that time that can ask for a baby for sure.
Gabriel Rodriguez confirms that in those days, Mapu's sexual revolution was in fact in full swing.
The Mapu was a network of people getting, not married, but sharing beds, let's say. So, and Fernando was part of that. And all my friends were part of that.
This political party, Mapu, does sound like a lot of fun. A mix of Marxists, hippies, and technocrats. As fate would have it, Stafford's grand entrance occurs just in time.
He was a fascinating guy for people in Chile, like us. Enormous beard and with the belt and he's talking and he's drinking. So probably he was involved on that. It's not probably 100% sure. The question is, how many? And that's the real question.
Stafford Beer's romantic pursuits are overshadowed by his efforts to defend himself against accusations of being a power-hungry technocrat.
Now, I have been very much blamed for doing this, and I resent the blame I've had very much. I've been told that I centralized power for Dr. Allende. This isn't the case at all.
Is it a classic case of misunderstanding? Stafford's critics might just fail to see that the centralizing features of CyberSyn are largely due to the limitations in computer technology and the resources available. Is their vision of having a computer in every factory really feasible in this country that is starved of resources? Sure, it's very alluring and Stafford agrees, but it's just not feasible in a Chile that is struggling with crisis on so many fronts. As Stafford points out in an interview, and I quote, Chile just cannot afford to dole out a ration of computers, for its prior problem is to dole out a ration of milk, end of quote. Well put. As Stafford points out, there is really nothing deliberately autocratic or authoritarian about the setup.
These data were not used in a autocratic fashion at all. They all went to one computer because we only had one computer. And if you've only got one computer, then ipso facto, you're centralized. But we were not centralized in the political sense in which this has been taken up by some critics.
Besides, he readily concedes that it's the Chilean workers who are the ones with the most comprehensive knowledge of their factories, as well as the processes that are happening within them. That's why the CyberSyn engineers go and interview them right before making those quantified flowcharts.
There is no one better qualified to model a plant than the man whose life is spent working in it. He knows. We have constructed a little tool in the quantified flowchart, and in handing this tool to the workers, we have no technocratic problems.
It may seem problematic that CyberSyn experts lead the modeling activity in each enterprise, but this technique goes back to Stafford's days in the steel industry. Back then, he hired experts in disciplines such as anthropology, zoology, and even Kantian philosophy. And they would dissect the steelworks through techniques learned in those fields. So the idea of a socialist utopia somehow dedicating time and resources to teach its workers about Kant, or zoology for that matter, solely for the purposes of modeling a caramel factory sounds a little bit far-fetched. But even if that comes to be, what about, say, chemistry and physics? Shouldn't the emancipated workers trust at least some experts? The crux of the disagreement here is whether management cybernetics is pure science, as Stafford seems to believe, or pure class warfare, as his leftist critics argue. The truth, as always, lies somewhere in between. There is something about the British critique of CyberSyn that doesn't feel quite right. Is CyberSyn exclusively for managers, as its critics claim? In a sense, of course, yes, because Corpus technocrats ultimately initiate and oversee it. But it's important to remember that in Allende's Chile, Corfu itself is being democratized, with unions even appointing members of its board. In principle, the workers can have a say in the redesign of the project, even if they played no role whatsoever in its conception. That, at least, is what the future holds. It's a classic chicken and egg scenario for Stafford and his opponents. Should you prioritize worker liberation first and then create a project like CyberSyn that caters to their specific needs and wants? Or do you start with a technocratic version of the project and only then gradually democratize it to meet the workers' real expectations? This debate, unfortunately, doesn't get settled. As the Chilean leftists debate some of these abstractions, the right-wing military is quietly plotting their next move. There are whispers of talks between the Chilean Navy and the Chicago Boys, focusing on the post-Allende economy and how to run it. The Navy needs a blueprint of some kind, and the Chicago Boys are happy to start working on one. And you can remain assured that it would be heavy on free markets and privatization. And the CIA, too, intensifies their effort. David Phillips, a veteran operative with a track record of success in Guatemala and Cuba and Brazil, has been tasked with weakening Allende. But with the stakes higher than ever, how far would he go to accomplish his mission? Phillips earned his reputation as a Cold War innovator and something of the CIA's own gossip czar in the run-up to regime change in Guatemala in 1954. We actually talked about it before on an earlier episode. Remember when Che Guevara, then just a humble doctor, found himself in Guatemala, observing its progressive government locked in a bitter struggle with the United Fruit Company? Well, eventually that firm mobilized its many friends in the CIA, and they trained a whole force of rebels that were keen to march on the capital. The numbers were relatively small, but this is where David Phillips came in. He leveraged the power of dark tech to make these rebels look like a real threat. Phillips employed a clever media strategy, radio transmissions, political songs, graffiti, and even disguised operatives who were distributing battery-powered radios throughout the country. And there was a very good reason to distribute all those radio sets. A covert radio station established by Phillips was disseminating what we now call fake news, duping the population into thinking that the opposition and this rebel force were actually much stronger and larger than they actually were. In fact, the president was eventually forced to step down, and the nation spiraled into a bloody civil war, a civil war that took hundreds of thousands of lives. And now it's very tempting for David Phillips, the mastermind behind it all, to try some of the same tricks on Allende's Chile. Guatemala, Cuba, Brazil. It's as if the CIA was mobilizing every trick it has learned in previous operations against the Chilean leader. How could Stafford's cybernetic software possibly protect Allende? And just weeks after taking office, Phillips does find himself facing a military coup in Santiago. The first sign of trouble comes one morning at the end of June, when a rogue officer leads a small but dangerous unit